Good evening, everybody, and welcome. And thank you very much to David, who is always so willing, so much a part of the family, that whenever he's passing Cape Town on his travels, he's prepared to lend his expertise to the Center for Extramural Studies. We're very grateful for that. As most of you, I think, know, David Attwell is professor and head of the Department of English at the University of York. And his 1992 book, Doubling the Point, is, I think, one of the most cited English literature reference works in the world on the subject of South African literature. And I have a feeling that the book that came out in May, which you can see standing here, J.M. Coetzee and the Life of Writing, I have a feeling that it will become just as important a resource for scholars in years to come. Not just for scholars, though, I think also for writers like me. It's the most wonderful, it provides the most wonderful insights into how books come to be, how writers manage to choose the words that become a novel like Waiting for the Barbarians. So if you haven't got a copy of David's book, Russell Martin, his publisher, is here with a special offer of 200 rand cash for the book after David's lecture. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Fanula. Thank you. It's always great to be back in Cape Town, and always a particular pleasure to be at UCT. So thanks for coming. It's lovely to be here. I'm going to be talking about Waiting for the Barbarians. This is the novel that really established Coetzee's international reputation, and I certainly regard this as one of South Africa's great national classics. In Giving Offence, his collection of essays on censorship, Coetzee wrote, "In the psychohistory of the white South African in the last years of apartheid, detachment of libido from the world took the form of an inability to imagine the future, a relinquishing of an imaginative grasp upon it." The remark had an element of introspection about it, because in his creative life, Coetzee had lived through the psychohistory that he describes here. In the late 1970s, he had embarked on a novel about South Africa, or a South Africa, in the aftermath of a revolutionary war. The project failed on these terms. It was only when he shifted the setting to a different context, an entirely imagined one, in which the specificities of South Africa were set aside, that he was able to make any progress with this project. Instead of the novel about revolution, what he produced was a novel about stasis, about paralysis in the face of an historical crisis. This novel was Waiting for the Barbarians. In the next novel, Life and Times of Michael Kay, he returned to the uncompleted project of South Africa undergoing a revolution, but again he veered away, becoming absorbed this time in his strangely liberated protagonist, Michael Kay. Waiting for the Barbarians was Coetzee's third novel, and as I mentioned when I began, the work that established his international reputation. His first novel, Dusklands, was started in 1970 in Buffalo, New York, and published in 1974. In that year, 74, he began a second novel, which he never completed, called The Burning of the Books. It was about censorship, based on an idea borrowed from the German poet Heinrich Heine, that the burning of books leads inevitably to the burning of bodies. He abandoned this project and instead wrote In the Heart of the Country, the novel many of you will know, published in 1977. In a notebook to The Burning of the Books, this unrealized project, he expresses resigned bewilderment, and I'm quoting here from the notebook, resigned bewilderment about the place one finds oneself in. Am I in the opening of Beckett's Molloy, he writes, or is this Robinson Crusoe? The remoteness, the placelessness, the unspecified empire of Waiting for the Barbarians is perhaps not altogether surprising in view of these comments about his being unsure about how to anchor himself with a sense of place in his fiction at this stage of his career. I also want to explore in this lecture, what I particularly want to explore in this lecture, is how setting or shifting the setting to a remote outpost of an unspecified empire helped Coetzee to overcome the difficulties he was having in writing Waiting for the Barbarians. What I also want to do is show that the novel's fictional milieu, despite its lack of specificity, does not make the novel any less a work of South Africa, any less a work of South Africa with all its historical tensions and ethical dilemmas. Let's begin then. Coetzee began writing Waiting for the Barbarians on the 11th of July, 1977, sketching the idea for the novel into a notebook. And here was his first entry. That would be a good idea. No, that's the auditorium, so we need... Border. Better?
Shall I leave the other one on?
Yeah. No, I don't have much to like to read with, but...
Is
there a light on the desk? Ah.
You want to put your papers there?
That's coming up from below. Maybe the other... Should I press on? Let's see how we go.
Okay.
So here it is. The theme, the middle of a revolutionary war in South Africa, the war remains throughout in the background. The place, an island transit camp for aliens waiting for transport out of the country. Robben Island, the prison, now a tired hotel with a launch bringing out supplies daily. In the weeks that he began the business of, let me turn now to the first page of the manuscript, which was written a few months later in September of 1977. I'll leave that with you for a minute, and I will read a couple of these paragraphs as I go. In these very weeks, between July when he sketched that notebook entry and September when he began to actually write the text, the censors were trying to reach a decision about the previous novel, In the Heart of the Country, which had been placed under an embargo at Johannesburg Airport, having been sent out by the British publishers. So it's tempting to conclude, as some critics did, that the displaced milieu of Waiting for the Barbarians was a tactic to evade the censors. But that inference would be quite wrong, because as you can see, when he began writing this novel, it was set in a highly recognizable Cape Town. In fact, in the teeth of probable censorship this time, he began to put together a story about South Africa after apartheid in which Robben Island is no longer a prison, but an embarkation station for white refugees who are fleeing the country in UN-chartered ships. And the manuscript begins like this. From the open window of the guardroom, Manos Millis watched the refugees trudge up the road that led from the jetty to the prison gates. The launch that had brought them was already halfway back to the mainland. It was plain that the crew were not talking to the people they had ferried, otherwise who would come? The style here was naturalism, the naturalism of Emile Zola, but a localized naturalism that his fellow Capetonian, Alex Laguma, had used with a fastidious listing of sordid detail. In Coetzee's prison-turned-transit station, a little further down in the passage, grass, thistles, clover had grown in the courtyard, splitting the flagstones. Mice had run in the corridors. In the toilet bowls, the water had dried up, leaving rings of rust. The only sound had been the cry of birds. Pigeon shit caked the window ledges. Gulls swooped into the courtyard at dusk. In his lodge, the watchman drank himself to sleep. To get from this localized realism to the wholly invented landscape of the final novel, I think you'll agree, was going to be a huge leap. But this naturalism proved to be a dead end, because after weeks of writing, It's clear to Coetzee that he is making several false starts, and he writes abandoned across the face of the manuscript in rather large black marker pen, letters in capitals half an inch high. Manos Millis is a 40-year-old Greek former teacher of ancient history, writing a book about the fall of Constantinople, assisting passengers to embark on a ship, the Anaconda, from the Cape Town docks. The ships are unable to leave because there's a dispute between the UN and the new government about who will pay for the fuel. The most promising aspects of Millis' story are his reflections on history, his conviction that history is best written when one stops imagining that the self lies at the center. Here, Coetzee was already exploring the position of the internal exile and discovering that it might be a liberating perspective, at least from the point of view of writing fiction. Some of the later magistrates' displacement and wistfulness had been discovered in Manos Millis, but of course Coetzee would still have been unaware of that fact. The plot of this story was fairly undeveloped. It's more a situation than a plot. It was going to be a dark romance with the interest falling on aggressive, unfocused sexual energies that are released by a revolutionary climate. With the German writer Robert Musil's novel, The Man Without Qualities, in the background, Millis was going to be, and I quote, an explorer of the vitalities thrown up by the last days of the Republic, literally a fin de siècle book. At one point, Millis is 50, the woman 21, 22, having left her husband or the husband having died. Incidentally, structures used later in his novel Disgrace keep appearing in these drafts. An older man, a younger woman, his absorption in an intellectual project, like the opera on Byron in that novel. These lovers have compulsive, despairing sex. They make a temporary home in a former prison cell. She withdraws from him and becomes passive and listless. He becomes sadistic in his efforts to revive her. She commits suicide. Charming story. The focus is all on the sexual restlessness, and there's just more than a hint of misogyny in Millis, which actually makes these early drafts quite difficult to read. At times, the sexuality of these encounters was to be what Freud called polymorphous perverse, which was his description of prepubescent erotic life. Millis was to have dreams of erotic tenderness without consummation. The beginnings of the relationship between the magistrate and the barbarian girl lie in these interactions. The magistrate's compulsive washing of the barbarian girl's feet, for example, those of you who know the novel. Coetzee was also reading the American Jerzy Kosinski's novel Painted Bird, which is a very disturbing, picaresque account of a child's experiences of cruelty and perversion during World War II Europe. In the climactic moments of his novel, or the novel he was trying to write, Coetzee imagined that Millis would become a burier of the dead, quote unquote, another foreshadowing of Disgrace, incidentally. But all these early manuscripts are labored, and Coetzee knew it. He writes in his notebook, after 22 pages, no liftoff yet. It would seem that I can get nowhere unless the whole thing turns into a drama of consciousness, a la In the Heart of the Country. But I can't face the prospect of writing at that hysterical intensity again. Once is enough, unquote. The missing ingredient, he told himself, was, quote, the creation, I need the creation of a credible and beloved you, unquote. But he couldn't see how he was going to do this while writing realism in the third person. So he wanted the novel to be driven by the desires of this male subject, but he was writing it in the third person and he couldn't inhabit that consciousness adequately. The point of the remark is that Manos Millis' energies were still too unfocused for the novel to have a clear direction. He also knew that he had to put his character into a narrative that had more momentum, but he couldn't work out how to do that. And so he writes in his notebook, I have no interest in telling stories. in the process, it's the process of storytelling that interests me. This man, Manos Millis, as a he living in the world, bores me. Creating an illusionistic reality in which he moves depresses me. Hence the exhausted quality of this writing. It's a very interesting piece of reflection from a novelist who's adjusting to having to produce a certain kind of realism because he thinks that that's what the genre is demanding of him, but he's resisting. He's wanting to write a much more self-conscious, layered kind of text. So he begins again. This time in the first person, he had been writing about Millis in the third person, he begins in the first person now, and crucially, for the eventual outcome of the novel, he turns Millis into a different kind of character in a different situation. He is now a guard at a border post. The title of the novel, which was decided very late in the process, came from the Greek poet from Alexandria, Constantine Cavafis, poem, Waiting for the Barbarians, also called Waiting for the Barbarians. But I don't believe that Cavafy was the catalyst for Coetzee. Rather, the catalyst seems to me to have been a poem by an American poet called Robert Duncan, a poem called The Song of the Border Guard. And that poem begins like this. The man with his lion under the shed of wars sheds his belief as if he shed tears. The sound of words waits, a barbarian host at the borderline of sense. So here we have a man of action who is losing his sense of identity, losing a sense of assurance, losing his convictions, and there's a storm of words in the background of his consciousness that he feels is going to overwhelm him and explain his life to him. I think that situation was very evocative for Coetzee in this novel. The imperial frontier in the poem is a metaphor for a certain unsettled subjectivity, a man of action in a state of paralysis, waiting for illumination. The discovery of this poem, or perhaps its rediscovery, was an important writing event. I talk about the writing events in Coetzee's writing, those moments when you can see a novel becoming what it wants to become. He has this enormous faith in the writing process, so you can see when the text, if you read the manuscripts, you can see when the text takes a quantum leap and begins to take shape. This was certainly one of those moments. The setting he kept deliberately vague at this stage. He was more interested in the character. Here's an extract from the notebook. Sometimes it's the Amazonian jungle, Aguira. I've added in square brackets here some explanation. This is a reference to Werner Herzog's film, Aguira, Wrath of God, about the conquistadors. Sometimes Central Asia, Buzzati. This is a reference to Dino Buzzati's novel, Il Deserto dei Tartari. Other possibilities, South Africa, colonial North America, Roman Europe. But he added, the position is beleaguered. They are all forgotten. Nevertheless, they do their duty. To address the problem of momentum in the story, he wanted to create what he called a plan for you, that is the beloved. The central character's lover. And he wrote, the various roles that this you can be tried out in are prisoner, camp woman, fellow inmate. Once this you is known, he wrote, the next problem is to find a home for you in the flesh and in the word. So until the possible focus and context of this you, the beloved, are found, the novel could not progress. So this you is a kind of Ariadne figure leading the guard, the border guard, on into a lair of some kind. But exactly what form that lair took was still very far from clear. Well, it would soon become clear. In the very weeks that Coetzee was wrestling with all of this material, South Africa became convulsed by another political catastrophe. And this was the death in detention of Stephen Biko, the Black Consciousness leader. An inquest took place in an open court which enabled the press, notably from Coetzee's point of view, the Cape Times, which was available and liberally inclined, to cover it in detail. Coetzee kept press clippings from the Cape Times and followed the story closely. So here's a press clipping from Coetzee's archives, and he kept all of this material. I'll pause there because this particular aspect of the inquest into Biko's death became important to the novel. Biko's torture and death gave Coetzee the Minotaur's lair, the habitation of the you that he was looking for, the situation in which his character's obsession with a female lover could be explored. That situation was the transformation of a placid border town by a reign of terror run by police agents from the capital. So the novel's development took the form of a simultaneous, seemingly contradictory two-way process, both a distancing into an unspecified empire at an unspecified moment in history, but also a homecoming into the violence of apartheid in its most climactic period. There was no single moment of illumination or crystallization. He worked his way towards these solutions through a period of intense experimentation that was always full of uncertainty. The uncertainty comes through in his notebooks quite frequently, and this is an example. On Christmas Day, see how frequently he wrote and how disciplined he was. On Christmas Day of 1977, he writes in his notebook, "It's a wholly unreal enterprise that I'm engaged in. No matter what, this is a book that could have been written 100 years ago. Exoticism, nothing more. There's no pressure of form on me, hence the lack of my engagement of feeling. The book comes straight out of the Western, long knives and redskins." 2 days later, only 2 days later, you get this. Going, okay, hard to believe I have at last found the form I wanted. To flesh out the setting, Coetzee began to research the geography of Mongolia for information about terrain, climate, flora. He made word lists in Mongolian. He researched the agriculture and the diet. His collection of papers on the subject is extensive. But the manuscripts also show that he was still frequently unsure of the results, unsure specifically that what he ought to be doing is creating a realistic portrayal at all. He regularly proposed reverting back to southern Africa too, especially southwest Africa, as it was still known, and wondered whether he should throw in a few Afrikaans words, despite the unspecificity of the setting, deliberately to confuse. So we would have a melange of reference, both realist and non-realist. And that would have emphasized the fictionality of the whole project. Those temptations were resisted. He kept going at the realism. I'm using realism in a particular sense here. Realism is a specifically literary term that involves creating a world that is easily imagined, through the practice of verisimilitude. It doesn't necessarily have to refer to a particular time and place. It just refers to the creation of a credible universe, as it were, with realistic detail. A key discovery, perhaps the most important one, because it enabled him to develop the magistrate's interiority, was to have found the voice. We still don't have a voice for the magistrate. And here it is. It first surfaced on the 4th of December, 1977, in epistolary form, that is to say, in the form of letters. Here he switches to the first person for the first time. So this is an official in a remote outpost of an empire writing back to the center to report on activities under his jurisdiction. In the second letter, written on the same day, this official no longer Millis, by the way, but now unnamed. You will note that he simply doesn't specify who this is, and at this stage of the writing, he's referring to this character as X. This writer reports on a minor chieftain called Jagatai, who has a seal from the emperor and who represents no danger. The official is trying to reassure the empire about the placid nature of the barbarians under his command, or under his watch. Jagatai appears in later drafts, along with names like Olot, Batal, the defiles of the Kumtag. So Coetzee was still working quite closely with his Mongolian materials. Later he takes out all the specificity, even these references to Western Asia. So how did this epistolary voice free Coetzee from the less productive labors that he was going through until this point? One answer is purely technical. The change from third person to first person narration enabled him to emphasize the subjectivity, so he could get inside the consciousness of the character. And Coetzee is never satisfied until he has worked his way into the drama of consciousness in the novel, and that, of course, is a signature of all of his writing. Another answer has to do with Coetzee's particular positionality, social positionality. He simply did not have the means to create the naturalistic detail that the novel about life in Cape Town after a revolution would require or demand of him. He makes the point himself. He says in his notebook, "When one is living a full life and working on a book, everything is transmuted. With a thin life, I'm writing a thin book." To bring off the naturalistic novel, in other words, he would have needed to be much closer to the personalities, the intrigues, the aspirations, the disappointments of life lived on the street. To do that, you have to be Nadine Gordimer, not John Coetzee. So instead of the social canvas, what Coetzee could construct was this psychological inner drama of displacement. And if he didn't have a fictional setting for such a project, well, he would just have to create one. Hence the turning to his Mongolian materials. In a certain sense, the milieu that Coetzee created was familiar territory because it was on the near side of revolution rather than after it. Furthermore, this shift to an historically vague, allegorical landscape is consistent with his diagnosis of colonial history as a continuing moral crisis. In his autobiography, Youth, he writes, "Between black and white, there is a gulf fixed. People like himself are here on this earth, the earth of South Africa, on the shakiest of pretexts." Now, you might well wonder about my taking this voice from Youth as autobiographical. We can talk about that. I'm doing that quite deliberately, and I think it's legitimate to do so, and we can have that discussion. But it's a short step from that kind of social pessimism to the mythic divided world of Waiting for the Barbarians. The newly discovered milieu enabled Coetzee to draw on his resources, including, paradoxically, the Karoo. So Mongolia is miles away from the Karoo, but there's something about the Karoo in the landscape of the novel. If you're not sure what the Karoo is, here's an image of the landscape, particularly arid, around Prince Albert, which is the hamlet, the village, the town, which has featured so strongly in his life. That's an arid example. At sunset, it becomes very picturesque. He writes in his notebook for Waiting for the Barbarians, "Make the desert more like the Karoo." So if you think I'm making this up, it comes from his notes. And in fact, there are numerous Karoo-like moments in the published novel. Here's one of them. "Summer is wheeling to an end. The orchards groan under the burden. In the sky, there are a million stars. We are on the roof of the world. I open my eyes in the middle of the night and lie dazzled." Those of you who know the Karoo will know how accurate that is, although it's so evocative and nostalgic. This pathos, this love of country, came out of a writer who had spent parts of his childhood on Fulfontein, the family farm between Prince Albert and Merweville. and who in later years was persuaded that the whole way of life that Fourfontaine represented was now coming to an end. Fourfontaine is a beautiful farm. This is the farmstead, the farm of Coetzee's childhood that he writes about so lovingly in Boyhood. And those orchards groaning under the weight of their fruit, well, he didn't make them up. There was also the reading that Coetzee had done before writing Dusklands on the ethnography of the Nama and their interactions with the Dutch settlement. Waiting for the Barbarians empties these known colonial discourses of their specific ethnic markers, but the novel retains the sharp cultural differences and the conflicting lifestyles of the 18th century Cape. Now, the role of Steve Biko in this novel, well, it was central, but by no means straightforward. He writes in his notebook, "This may not be entirely honest, but I must make the relation of the story to the Biko affair, the inspiration of the story by the Biko affair, clearer. End it, perhaps, with a massive trial scene in which the accusers get put in the dock," unquote. Well, a trial scene was never written, but Colonel Joel and his henchmen in the novel certainly do look beleaguered at the end. The fictional translations of the political context of the Biko inquest are clear enough in the novel. There is the clampdown by the security detail. This is the equivalent of the Bureau for State Security in South Africa. You'll remember, aptly named BOS, renamed the Third Bureau after Tsarist Russia in Coetzee's novel. There is the torture chamber and the effects of these things on people of liberal conscience represented by the magistrate. Why would Coetzee wonder whether it was not entirely honest to admit that these elements derive from the Biko affair? The answer is that what actually happened is that he absorbed these developments into a structure, the essential elements of which he had already worked out. It was important to the novel's taking off that he should write about desire, or write desire into being, a project requiring that elusive and female you. After the introduction and the fictionalization of the political events, after the introduction of the theme of torture particularly, this you becomes the barbarian girl of the novel, a torture victim crippled and partially blinded by Colonel Joel, a girl whom the magistrate takes into his rooms where the previously imagined polymorphous perverse sexuality of Manos Millis finds a new, highly charged and culturally loaded application. The problem of finding the right habitation for desire, for the erotic tensions of the Millis text, was solved by the contemporaneous events taking place in the country just at the time when Coetzee most needed them for his creative process. The sociological cocktail that Coetzee had invented here was immensely charged and powerful, a combination of peculiar sexuality involving a tortured body, cultural difference, and a regime on the brink of collapse. He nevertheless continued to think that what he was doing was insecure, and he had radical uncertainties about the project all the way through. He writes in the notebook, "It's difficult to believe in this ridiculous story. My only hope is that some transmutation will occur to me." His intuitions were that, quote, "the sexual alienation of the man had better be linked to the torture," unquote. He would have to convey a sense that there was, quote, "no privileged space left for the body, that this man will have to live through what is going on in the torture room himself more intensely," unquote. He also sensed that the man would have to undergo pain in a graphic way. He writes, "Why not let him be wounded in the attack of the barbarians on his party? Of course, that attack never happens, but instead the magistrate becomes the victim of torture himself." I'll come back to that. For the next year and a half, Coetzee took these provocations and this incredibly charged narrative structure that he had developed with him as he developed one version after another. In late 1978, a year after he began, he embarked on a reading campaign to give himself more resources. In his notebooks, he began to list the themes and the quotations of this read that he took down from his reading. He read about ceremonies and their rituals. He read about funerals. He read about despair and suicide in Kierkegaard and Pasternak and Henry James. He reread Flaubert, and he lifts from Flaubert this rather lovely quotation. In days gone by, people thought that only sugar yielded... In days gone by, people thought that only sugar cane yielded sugar. Nowadays, they get it from practically everything. It's the same way with poetry. That intrigued Coetzee for some reason. He reread Roland Barthes on the subject of pleasure. He read Octavio Paz. He read Henri Bergson on space, which is particularly appropriate given the fictionalization of this milieu. He read Walter Ong on sound and orality. He read Leo Bersani on Madame Bovary, thinking about wordiness and garrulousness in response to, as a way of expressing desire. He read Freud on dreams, and there are dreams in this novel, a whole sequence of really powerful, evocative dreams, if we could trace. Walter Ong is quoted as saying, "Barbarians turn out rather regularly to be the custodians of the culture on which they prey." Interesting. He read Paul Ricoeur on the body. He read Simone de Beauvoir on what it means for a woman to be dressed. He read George Steiner on fantasies of invasion. He read Simone Weil's aphorism, or he read Simone Weil and wrote down her aphorism, "The crime which is latent in us we must inflict on ourselves." And that quotation finds its way into the final text. We could follow each of these threads, these quotations or intertextual allusions, and work out what they contributed to the project. At this point, I just want to note how Coetzee's reading works in relation to his creativity. There's a suspicion, a kind of mythology out there that Coetzee writes novels as allegories of quotations from other literary theorists, and it's just not true at all. And it's what clearly happens is that he works very hard, as we're seeing. Oh, what's happened here? He works very hard, as we can see, at making sure that the novel finds its own feet, and then he brings in the additional cultural material that he needs in order to develop the project. Should I try the... There we are. So I just need to go back now. That's where we were, wasn't it? Okay. By June 1979, nearly 2 years after he began, he had a typescript, which he continued to revise by hand and retype. Much of the later manuscripts, the retyping, the redrafting, were done while he was traveling. He spent from January to May of 1979 back in the linguistics department at the University of Texas at Austin, where he'd done his PhD, followed by the northern summer months, June, July, and August, in the linguistics department at Berkeley in California. By his own account, this was a lonely but a productive period. He wrote a number of linguistic studies on syntax, and he finished his novel. The two most important developments, as the novel found its momentum, were the following. Firstly, the arrival of those security agents from the capital, led by Colonel Joel, because that triggers that very powerful first third about torture, and that section in which the magistrate reacts against Colonel Joel's practices and then forms this empathetic bond, this eroticized sympathy with the barbarian girl in particular who's undergone torture. So the arrival of Colonel Joel. And the second important development is that relationship with the barbarian goal. In the arrival of Joel and his team, the parallels between the report submitted by Joel to the magistrate on the death of a prisoner and police accounts of Biko's death at the inquest, where it was found that no one was to blame, those parallels are unmistakable. The circumlocution of the security police is what survives in the published text. So this comes from the novel itself. During the course of the published version of the novel, during the course of the interrogation, contradictions became apparent in the prisoner's testimony. Confronted with these contradictions, the prisoner became enraged and attacked the investigating officer. A scuffle ensued during which the prisoner fell heavily against the wall. Efforts to revive him were unsuccessful. Now, as we read this, what we are registering is the circumlocution, the official discourse, the impassivity, the lack of responsibility on the part of Colonel Joel, because we know through the account we've had from the magistrate exactly what has taken place already, and that is that the prisoner has been murdered. I want to take you now to the first draft of this to show you how close it was to the Biko case. I understand, Colonel, that another of the prisoners died under interrogation. How did that come about? Ah, yes, that happened a few days ago. Yes, we were questioning him. We confronted him with a statement he had made earlier, a statement which contradicted what he is now saying, what he was now saying. He went berserk. He attacked us. It took four of us, myself, Colonel B, and our two assistants, to bring him under control. There was a scuffle. In the course of the scuffle, his head came into contact with the wall. I understand that was the cause of death, an injury to the brain. Now, some of you may even remember, but certainly if you looked at the court records as reported in the press, this is almost a verbatim account of the security police's defense at the inquest. This was written a month after the inquest. Coetzee was using his press clippings, writing at white heat. In later revisions, we find him omitting brain injury while retaining the official evasiveness, which is the residue that I showed you earlier. An incident of Biko throwing himself at his attackers is retained but recontextualized. The elderly victim becomes the girl's father. The magistrate imagines that his rage would have been the result of his seeing his daughter witnessing his suffering and humiliation. So, in one version, Coetzee shifts the pathos into the parent-child relationship. So you can see then how he's playing with this very topical, contemporaneous material. In the relationship between the magistrate and the barbarian girl, Coetzee had found his vehicle for exploring desire. But the configuration introduced by the Biko material changes the emphasis to an exploration of the effects of violence on the relationship, on intimacy. When the magistrate discovers that true reciprocity is impossible under these conditions, under conditions of structural inequality, when the girl is clearly not a free subject and can't commit to him freely, behind this is a philosophical position that comes from Hegel that I won't go into now, but when the magistrate realizes that true reciprocity is impossible, he decides that he must return the girl to her people. So he organizes an expedition. When the journey reaches its destination and she is given the choice, she chooses to free herself from his clutches and go back to her people. On his return to the settlement, despite the flagrantly personal nature of this whole quest, the magistrate is accused of collaborating with the enemy, tortured himself, and publicly humiliated. Thereafter, the colonel leaves the settlement, which is now in a state of anxious disorder, expecting to be overrun at any point. And only the children provide a measure of hope for a different future in the novel's closing paragraph. Once Coetzee had found his milieu and the dramatic potential of torture, his writing focused on the magistrate's attentions to the girl. Initially, in early drafts, we find out about her condition through the magistrate's misapprehensions. She hobbles. He assumes that this is because her feet were bound as a child. So he's drawing on cultural stereotypes in order to understand her, but then he's proved wrong. She begs with a bowl before her kneeling. He wonders why she can't sit cross-legged. Her feet are wrapped in rags and felt. He assumes that this is because she has no shoes and so forth. Soon he learns the truth, which is that she has been damaged by beatings on the ankles. He obsesses about her now, has distorted dreams about her, and then brings her into his rooms and gives orders to take her into service rather than having her beg on the streets. At the magistrate's insistence, the girl removes the bandages, the thongs, and the shapeless sheepskin slippers from her feet and begins to wash her. Two elements of these encounters stand out as sharply different from the published text. So here I'm contrasting the drafts of these interactions from Coetzee's manuscripts and notebooks with what appears in the published text. The first is that the magistrate actually communicates with this girl in the local patois. So the magistrate speaks the local patois of the barbarians quite fluently in the early drafts of this book. And here, Coetzee is clearly deploying, playing with the social possibilities of Afrikaans. Secondly, there's the question of the sexuality. In the drafts, the sexuality is much more explicit than it is in the novel. In the final version, the magistrate's exhaustion is unconnected to anything quite so specific as orgasm. Instead, in the published text, the eroticism has a poetic indirection about it, as if the tiredness were a psychological manifestation of the deficiencies of the relationship, or of metaphysical longings in the magistrate that the girl can't answer. Here's an example of this writing from the published text. In the very act of caressing her, I'm overcome with sleep as if poleaxed, fall into oblivion, sprawled upon her body, and wake an hour or two later, dizzy, confused, thirsty. These dreamless spells are like death to me, or enchantment, blank, outside time. I touch my lips to her forehead. What did they do to you? I murmur. My tongue is slow. I sway on my feet with exhaustion. Why don't you want to tell me? She shakes her head. On the edge of oblivion, it comes back to me that my fingers running over her buttocks have felt a phantom crisscross of ridges under the skin. Nothing is worse than what we can imagine, I mumble. She gives no sign that she has even heard me. I slump on the couch, drawing her down beside me, yawning. Tell me, I want to say. Don't make a mystery of it. Pain is only pain. But words elude me. My arm folds around her. My lips are at the hollow of her ear. I struggle to speak. Then blackness falls. The indirection of this, the inherent insufficiencies, inadequacies of the relationship, exacerbating the magistrate's desires, but they will remain inconclusive, and that is what is so powerful in this writing. Well, the first attempts at these passages are far less evocative and far more specific. He washes her entirely, her genitals, her anus. He lies down with her. He rubs her with oil. She strips, places her foot against his penis. And quote, when he feels the faintest arch of the foot, the faintest answering pressure of her toes, at once he ejaculates. All this is omitted. So when you work on manuscripts, you come across this material that you have to decide what to do with. And this is a good example. So all of this is omitted from the final text. And instead, it's the indirection of the encounters that survives. And this is what is most celebrated in the criticism, incidentally. The mystery of this indirection, the otherness, the alterity that the magistrate can't overcome. What the manuscripts reveal is that that quality of indirection is a function of judicious editing. of tactical omissions. So deletion is shown to be central to the process of invention and not incidental to it. It's not an afterthought. It's part of the process. Matters change in the relationship when the magistrate looks into the girl's eyes and finds them, quote, dead, flat, like the eyes of a fish. A hot iron has been brought too close to her face and left her blind. The discovery sickens him. His nighttime attentions become full of nostalgia. From this moment on, the magistrate knows that things cannot continue as before, and he determines that he must take her back. The climactic moment in Waiting for the Barbarians occurs when the magistrate, undergoing torture, imagines that he is on the point of death. He is made to ascend a ladder, blindfolded, with a noose around his neck, strung from the branch of a tree. His handler keeps the rope tight as he ascends. At the top, the ladder is pushed over, but because there is no free fall, he survives. But he is hanging precariously from the neck. In this moment, the image that comes to his mind is the image of the barbarian leader that he had encountered in the earlier expedition. He recalls, quote, standing in front of the old man, screwing up my eyes against the wind, waiting for him to speak. The girl, with her black hair braided and hanging over her shoulder in barbarian fashion, sits her horse beside him. Her head is bowed. She, too, is waiting for him to speak. I sigh. What a pity, I think. It's too late now. That's from the published novel. In an earlier version of this, the magistrate's reflections are much more elaborately developed. There's a kind of political specificity about this writing that I found really intriguing. From the moment my eyes lighted on her sitting at the barracks gate, she was wrapped in a miasma of lies, carried across the desert too by a man comically self-deceived. What did I want with the barbarians? I thought of marrying into them, not because I longed for a pastoral existence, but to become the owner of the marks on her body, to hear her go through a ceremony in which she acknowledged them as mine. How could I have believed her so stupid? From first to last, she listened to her heart and acted in harmony with it. She knew me for a false seducer from the very first. Who knows? If she had had the words, she might even have told me the truth, told me what was in my own heart. Join your colonel with the black eyes. Find a fresh body. Let him show you how to sign it with your mark. Well, what can we learn or conclude from all of this? Coetzee's efforts to imagine a future after apartheid had to focus on the psychology of transition and on intimacy if he was to be the person to carry off this narrative. A novel that begins by probing a psychosexual malaise at the end of history becomes a narrative about the effects of violence on the imagination and on intimacy. The invention of a credible, largely unprecedented fictional universe was an extraordinary imaginative feat on his part. But Coetzee had discovered that what he could write was not the story of a revolution, but the story of an impasse. A year of writing Barbarians, he realized that what the book was actually about was waiting. Quote, waiting for a desire which does not come because one is waiting for it. He continues, waiting for Godot is about waiting for a subject, unquote. He then added a few days later, the center of his bafflement must be, he's referring to the magistrate here, the center of his bafflement must be that his life has never become truly emblematic, even at its crisis points. The meeting with the barbarians was vacuous. No words were exchanged. The police are not simply evil. The girl refuses to betray her meaning to him. And finally, the barbarians do not come. And then he underlines this sentence. This is a novel in which meaning is continually held back I quote. Coetzee was anxious to reassure himself that the novel he had written embodied a suitable degree of literary self-awareness. At one point, he considered introducing a marginal commentary, an idea strengthened by reading of Jacques Derrida's work of philosophy, Glass, which is Derrida's reading of Hegel and Genet, in which the text takes the form of a commentary plus marginal notes, printed on the same page, that is. Coetzee then adds, however, just another twist of self-consciousness is what I don't want. So he did stick to the realist project, if you like. He did want to get the story out. Another twist of self-consciousness is what I don't want. Instead, perhaps, a series of quotations. Not sources, just illuminations. Unquote. The paragraphs that are penned by the magistrate towards the end of the novel have just that quality. They are inconclusive speculations. So suspension and withheld meaning are essential features of Waiting for the Barbarians. Coetzee followed his own lights in pursuit of this irresolute conclusion. But, of course, paradoxically, suspension and withheld meaning are also highly suggestive of a society in a state of paranoia, seemingly on the edge of dissolution, unable to imagine a future like the South African regime in the last years of apartheid. Thank you. I'll stop there. Yeah, absolutely. Fine. Should we turn lights on?
Are there any questions for David? You will remember to repeat the questions
now. Yes, by all means. I'll take you back to the picture of the orchard, which is a bit more pleasant. Thank you, you've been a wonderfully attentive audience. But I'm very happy to take some questions if there are any.
David, did any of the critics of the time mention the Biko connection, or was that something you alone?
Yeah, found? No, they did. They did notice it. But of course, we weren't absolutely sure that this was a real connection. And it was a controversial question in itself, because Coetzee is known as a writer who deliberately displaces his fiction from the realities of the South African situation. So that while there were some people, including myself, who said, no, this is surely close to the Biko affair, other critics were saying, it's impossible, you know, he's not that kind of writer. Well, here we are. You know, undoubtedly. He kept all those press clippings from the Cape Times. I believe that Helen Ziller wrote a lot of that copy. Isn't that interesting? Yeah.
How personal or autobiographical are the sexual difficulties?
Yeah.
We don't know.
Thank God we don't know. But we don't know. You know, he's certainly a writer who's capable of thinking his way into a different kind of subject altogether. So this is the respectable answer to your question. In the actual details of the relationship, I would say no autobiography whatsoever. But insofar as he is able to imagine himself in the state of being of that character, imagine that character's situation informed by his sense of historical anxiety and displacement. What would sexuality feel like under those conditions? You can only write that story by inhabiting the character. And when he says in his notebooks, you know, I'm not going to solve the problem of this novel until I can discover this you, he's actually putting his own desiring self into the subject in order to make that fictional leap possible. So it's autobiographical in that sense, but that's not the same thing at all as saying that Coetzee was in a similar kind of relationship. I mean, I wouldn't go there as a critic. It just doesn't seem to me plausible. Yeah. Yes. Thank you.
But you said that he had difficulty in writing a boxer, which was one of the reasons for displacing the city.
Yes.
I had always assumed from my reading of Waiting for Barbades that he deliberately displaced it in order to give the certainty rather than tying it to a specific place.
Yes, yes. I wouldn't want to contradict that at all. And I do sense that as a writer who's following the example of the great modernists, I mean, his models are T.S. Eliot. In fact, in the drafts, there's a stage in the writing of the drafts when he calls a section of the novel The Burial of the Dead. And he imagines Millis performing ceremonies, funeral ceremonies, and that is clearly, surely, a reference to the opening of the Wasteland. So the essential position in modernism is to try to extract yourself from the specificities of the story and universalize it to achieve enough aesthetic detachment for it to become a universal allegory of some kind. So he's definitely on that road when he moves the milieu to this unspecific time and place. But the energies in the story are clearly South African. When he begins to work with the Biko material, he's writing about the ethical dilemmas that confront a person of liberal inclinations who is living through a totalitarian, or living in a totalitarian culture for which he is made to take responsibility. And he's trying to overcome that position through empathy. You know, he wants the barbarian girl to understand him as a unique and different individual. That is clearly a South African problem, isn't it? So it's a simultaneous displacement from South Africa, but also a homecoming in a way. And what I'm suggesting is that the creativity that produces this novel is a result of that tension. Yeah. Ah, thank you. The which references, sorry? Yeah.
He was influenced by Orwell's writing.
Orwell. I'm not repeating questions, are I?
Yeah, the totalitarian references.
Yeah. So was Coetzee influenced by the totalitarian references in Orwell? I didn't see Orwell in the manuscripts or the notebooks. So I'd be reluctant to say that Orwell was a direct reference or direct influence, but undoubtedly Coetzee had absorbed Orwell. So Orwell would be there in the background somewhere, and his misgivings and apprehensions about what it is like to live under an authoritarian regime would have been informed to some extent by his reading of Orwell, I'm quite sure. But we won't see, I don't think we'll see specific textual references to, say, 1984. Well, in any case, I think that's, I can't add to that answer. Yeah. The back. Oh, yes.
When your PhD students got the title, you won that award for the essay.
Yeah.
One of the interesting
things is to toss out my rhetorical question. Hadley writes,
why don't students of color?
Hmm.
And it's an interesting line that kind of hangs over the article in a way. And I think you
really liked
about your talk. Transformative insofar as there's a way to get
students interested in this book, but traditionally maybe it's
only
student side, I guess.
But at the same time, I guess I wonder, how would you respond to certain very systems of good state? Like, I feel like Abdul-Jabbar Muhammad's, like, it's kind of this guilt, but this sort of certain problems. I didn't know displacement you're talking about, he could say it begins.
There to respond to. I think we got the gist of the question. Let me start with Abdul Jan Muhammad. I mean, he specifically says Coetzee is being evasive. Right? He doesn't tackle the question of apartheid because he's writing in 1977 and all these ghastly things are going on, and he avoids dealing with South Africa, and instead he writes this broadly allegorical text. Well, even without knowing that Coetzee was working with material that comes out of the Steve Biko murder and inquest, one wouldn't take much to work out that Abdul Jan Muhammad is quite wrong, frankly, because it's clear even on the terms of the novel's first publication without the evidence of this archive that the issues clearly relate to what it's like to live through a culture that's undergoing dissolution. And the Manichaean, Jan Muhammad talks about the Manichaean allegory of colonial writing and puts Coetzee into that box. The Manichaean allegory that Coetzee is writing about is specifically apartheid discourse, right? Displaced into a fictional situation in which one can read it and get some leverage on it and understand how it works. So, you know, I think Jan Muhammad's reading is remarkably shallow, to be honest. And he doesn't see that actually the fictional empire is Coetzee's replaying and fictionalization of the late apartheid state, if you like, which is undergoing that kind of paranoid dissolution. So he's just wrong, if I may be so blunt. But coming back to the earlier part of your question, which you quoted from Headley's asking the question, why don't black students read Coetzee? Well, you know, the situation is more nuanced than that. You know, I was at the Franschhoek Literary Festival, and Tikeng Mohala comes up to me and says, I love doubling the point, you know, that Coetzee's early novels have been so influential for me, et cetera, et cetera. You know, I've had loads of conversations of that kind. The kind of situation that Headley's writing about is all about popular perceptions of the debate around Coetzee after disgrace. But this is a very long career, right? And you know, just to give you something personal, I was teaching this novel, Waiting for Barbarians, and others at UWC in the early 1980s. And you know, I remember very clearly the conversations with students there about this novel. As far as they were concerned, Coetzee was a comrade. No question about it. He was a comrade. Why? Because he showed us what it was like to be in the mind of empire, you know. And he showed us how these liberal subjects struggle to overcome their position and to relate to people outside of their mental universe and fail. And what kinds of dilemmas do they get themselves into? You know, clearly Coetzee was a kind of white ant, you know, within the imperial system, who could expose that system for those students. That's how they read him. It was uncomplicated. It was obvious to him that he was a progressive, challenging writer. It's rather sad to me that none of that early reception of Coetzee's work seems to be remembered in more recent discussions following disgrace. But even in those more recent discussions, I think the situation is more nuanced than you suggest. What I'm trying to do is show that this writer who does not publicly engage on these questions because he respects the creative process so intensely himself that, you know, for him, it's all apparent in his novels, or it's not apparent anywhere. He's not going to enter the public discussion about his fiction. And that contributes to a sense that he is rather aloof and detached and so forth, and I think that's partly what Headley's referring to as well. But what I'm trying to show in this book, and through tracing the creative process that produces these extraordinary national classics, and I use that with as much weight as I can, I use that phrase with as much weight as I can, I think they are national classics, is show the humanity of the process. Right? To show that Coetzee's work is, in fact, deeply autobiographical in one sense, that he is so intensely invested in the material. There is an incredible degree of discipline and self-consciousness that goes into it. And he is always focused on the kinds of ethical and aesthetic issues that come up in our historical context. That context is the spur, the grit in the oyster of all of this writing. So I do think that if we can show how the writing evolves, then writers of and readers, you know, of any hue can engage with that process and learn something about how great literature is energized by the culture that we live in. Okay.
So I just thank David again for taking us to the delivery room and the Ways of the Barbarians, and a reminder that Monday you can hear about the Master of Peaceburg, and a reminder about the book for sale. Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.